So then from Alabama, you went up to New York.
Briefly stopped in Maryland, and my parents were kind enough to let me stay in my old bedroom for about a month. I think I was 27 at the time, and I was like, my God, I'm living with my parents and I'm 27. This is really wrong.
What did they think of this career move?
To their great credit, they were and they still are my biggest fans. When I told them, and I was very scared to tell them because I think that, other than my mother, I didn't know anybody who was in the arts. I didn't grow up knowing musicians or painters or actors or writers or whatever. I knew one writer at Johns Hopkins. It was very influential in my career, a wonderful dear friend of mine by the name of Neil Grauer. And Neil had been a journalist for the News American and the Sun, and he's a cartoonist and a caricaturist as well. He created the legendary Hopkins Blue Jay logo that they had in it. And he is very beloved by Hopkins, the Hopkins lacrosse community. Neil was the only person I knew at Johns Hopkins who was in anything remotely connected with the arts. And it's kind of sad. This was before Hopkins had taken possession of Peabody and, years before all that happened. So, and Hopkins doesn't have an arts reputation. So I didn't know artists. I didn't know people that made their living writing or dancing with their feet or singing with their voice. I didn't know anybody. So for me to look at my parents and say, I think I want to move to New York and try to become an actor was like saying, I want to become an astronaut and fly to the moon.
But still, that must have been really reassuring for you that they were so supportive.
I mean, it was a great shot in the arm because as soon as I said it, my mom got emotional because she, like any mother, she does. And she said, I think you'd be a great actor. And my father, who I think I was more scared of telling than my mom, my dad said the same thing. He said, I think you'd be a hell of an actor. Give it your best shot. Do it. Move, my dad was driving me to Penn Station to put me on the train to New York. I had found some old high school friends up there who I could sleep on their floor. And I did for 2 weeks. I slept on their floor till I found a place. And then I moved in with a couple of other people that they introduced me to. When I was standing at the door saying goodbye to my mom, and she was crying, and she looked at me and she said, I don't worry about you because you're always born under a lucky star. You'll do fine, and that really, to have my, my parents behind me, to have my parents, backing me up like that 100% was just something that I'll tell you, I know a lot of actors. I studied with a lot of actors. And I'd say half of the actors I ever knew or studied with, easily half of them, the parents were openly hostile, openly destructive to their children's dreams, literally actively trying to undermine or destroy their children's dreams by saying things like, when are you going to get a real job? When are you going to get serious? When are you going to come home? My parents didn't have, and I didn't want any help. I saved my money and I've always paid my own bills in life. But, a lot of actors and, were broke, they borrowed money from their parents. Their parents have helped pay for their, rent or something. And so then the parents use that as leverage against them to, eventually get them to quit their dream. It's terrible. I think the best thing that any parent can do for any child is if you think you've done a good job parenting, the best thing you can do is bless your child's pursuit of their dream, whatever their dream or their passion is. If you are going to undermine it or openly attack it or denigrate it in any way, then I don't think you thought you did a very good job as a parent. You're questioning your child because you're not sure or you're scared for your child because you didn't prepare them for the world.
That should be the rule, but unfortunately it seems to be the exception, because I knew people like you did that their parents just really were completely non-supportive. My parents are like yours, was always supportive, even at the worst times. It's really fortunate and great that you have parents like that.
Yeah, it's a credit to my mom and dad. It has really in some ways nothing to do with me. It speaks to their character and their confidence. And they thought they had done a good job with my sister Mary Stuart and I, and they did. They were really, you know, I couldn't have asked for better parents and more loving and supportive parents who were curious themselves and wanted to just discover new things themselves, and they sort of passed that on to my sister and I. And so, you know, that's just dumb luck. I mean, there, as you say, there are lots, and most people I think are born with, you know, to parents who are not as curious and not as supportive and doubt what they've done as parent in parenting. And then they sort of spread those doubts and fears onto their grown children. And I think that's a mistake. Yeah.
I think you hit on it, besides being supportive, that your parents stayed curious, yeah, which is something, you know, I think people should do their whole lives. Stop examining things and you just stop living, I think.
Absolutely. And you got one foot in the grave. You're absolutely right. You know, you got to be curious. You got to be discovering. You got to be learning something new all the time and creating those, you know, I mean, they're proving it now in the neural sciences. You create brand new neural pathways through the brain every time you're learning something new. And, you know, I have to just kick myself all the time to say, you know, come on, what's the new thing? What am I going to do next? You know, because it's the only way to keep your brain and your mind and your body young. It's the only way.
Yeah. You know? I was just going to say that's the way you keep young. You keep learning. You keep experiencing new things. Now, you're sleeping on the floor in New York. Now what?
Well, I just poured myself. My parents had met, again, this is like my mom's and dad both, but I think my mom's probably my best publicist ever. They met some people at a party, and she said, oh, you know, my son wants to pursue acting. And someone said, oh, I know some managers in New York. I happen to know some. My mom said, can I get that name and number? She passed it on to me. And I met my first managers because of my mom and dad actively talking about my dream, you know, at a party, you know, they went to. So I met these managers and they basically said, go away. You know, I met one of them on literally a very, very wet, very cold, rainy day in February of 85. And she said, you know, go away. You don't have a resume. You don't have a headshot and you're dressed like a banker. And, you know, I'm a manager of acting talent. You need to go get, you know, come back in a few years. And, you know, I did something that was kind of audacious. I sort of put one elbow on her desk and leaned in and said, you know, I'm not an actor, but I want to be. And I'm a really hard worker. So why don't we do this? Why don't you pull out a yellow pad and make a list of the things I have to do and who I should go see and give me some names and numbers. And I can tell you what I will do. I'll do every single thing you put on that list. I'll cross everything off. And you tell me what to do. I'll go do it and I'll come back. And that's what happened. And I got into classes. I studied voice and diction because I had what was known as a Philadelphia dialect. You know, from Philadelphia through Baltimore to the northern tip of West Virginia, there's a corridor of people who have, as we all think of it, as a Balmer dialect. And people think it's Balmerese. It's actually called a Philadelphia dialect. And, you know, how you doing, hon? And I had to get rid of that and get a standard speech and get rid of my regional dialect.
Like you sounded, so, you came from nowhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I came from, you know, I go down the ocean and go to the hall, you know, go to Cavern Hall, you know, Delaney, you know, it was
alas, poor Oryk. I knew him well.
That's right. Exactly. So I was doing that a couple days a week. I found some classes through Backstage, the newspaper for actors. Started taking classes on camera, and I couldn't afford it, so I asked to get a job there, and I worked part time as operating the camera and literally sweeping the floors, trash after the class was over at night. Took on camera classes for commercials and how to do a soap opera scene and how to do a movie scene. And, you know, and then I entered a 2-year Meisner program that was a 2-year commitment, a studio program after I'd done a 6-week intensive summer program. And so from 1985 to the spring of 1988, I was in 2 to 3 classes a week year round. You know, I mean, I just was always studying and going down to TKTS where you can get the 50% off discount tickets in Times Square. And in those days, I could get a Broadway ticket for 20, $23, $24, $25. And
so you were seeing everything you could.
I was seeing
including showcases and everything.
I was going to showcases. I was going to one-person shows. I was going to off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway, Broadway. If I wasn't in the theater, I was going to a movies and seeing, watching how actors did things and trying to mimic and copy people and understand and learning how to work in front of a camera and learning that English is spoken in 4x4 meter and what an operative word is and what a beat was and what an action was and what an impediment was, what an internal obstacle or impediment is versus an external obstacle or impediment. Learning what the event was, what the arc of a character was, how you have to start in one place and finish in another, and the journey of a character, and studying Joseph Campbell and mythology, and reading as many plays as I could, and studying Shakespeare and reading and understanding. It never stops.
So you approached it like you approached lacrosse, all that. Well, right?
Yeah, I mean, I loved it, so it wasn't. It was a lot of work, but it wasn't painful. It was fun. It was just, I loaded myself up. I wanted to be, my mother had said to me at one point when I was, before I announced I wanted to be an actor, when I said I was thinking about it. And she said, why don't you work at the bank and become an actor and do dinner theater in Baltimore? And I remember saying to her, Mom, I can't do that. I don't want to dip a toe into it. I'm not going to put my toe in the ocean. I'm going to jump in the ocean and have it go over my head. I want to be swimming in it. I want to be maybe drowning in it, but maybe swimming gloriously in it if I work hard. I want to be in the ocean. I don't want to be, in a little pond, I don't want to do that. And for me, I always said to them, I said, it's either up or out. Either I'm going up or I'm going to get out. And there's a couple times I almost left the business and the craft, and I still think that I have another career in me still, and maybe I do, and that'll be fine. But I just immersed myself in classes and study. I remember these managers wanted to send me out on soap opera auditions, and I was like, I don't want to go. And they looked at me like I had two heads. They said, you don't want to go. You're very relaxed. You can play yourself. That's all soap opera requires. And I said, no, I don't. I want to know more about the craft, and I don't even like soap operas. And they looked at me like, you know how much money you can make? I said, I know, but I don't like them, so I don't want to do them. And I don't think they were used to that. And they said, yeah, but you do commercials, which I did like, I don't know, 5 or 6 dozen commercials in my career. And I was making a living, getting the residuals off commercials, and they paid for my classes eventually. This is after all the typical actor jobs of being a waiter, a bartender, a doorman, a cater waiter. I did all those things too. I said, yeah, but commercials, you shoot it and you're done. And it's a commercial, everybody knows it. But, if I'm tied into a soap opera and I'm tied into that contract, I don't want to be tied down. And I want to learn how to do classic theater before I learn.
Before you get tied down.
In some ways, I wish I had continued further down that road. When I first started to get some primetime television, when I got Cosby and those things, it led – I very quickly got – some people in the television industry wanted me to work more. And I, in some ways, I wish I had gone back to New York instead of moving to LA and stuff.
How did that happen, the Cosby Show?
I did my first Equity play, which was The Glass Menagerie, at an Equity theater in North Jersey, where they used to pick us up in New York City and take us out of the theater there. And I got my Equity card. And then an agent came out and saw me, and she said she wanted to sign me, and she did. And then she submitted me to The Cosby Show, and I went in on a cattle call where they saw, like, it was, I remember I had one scene, and it was delivering a couch to a brand new couch with a fellow delivery man to Bill Cosby's house. And it was a scene with Cosby. And I remember when I went in, it was right before Christmas. They were casting it, and then they were going to shoot it when we came back. And I remember I went in, and I was wearing I had seen a pair of pink foam antlers on the street that, like, sucked onto your head. And I remember I put it on right before I went in the room. And as soon as I walked in the room with those antlers on, all the writers cracked up. And I said, what? I just looked at them deadpan. I said, what? And they started laughing. They laughed harder. And I said, what? You're like looking at me like I got something on my head or something. I don't know, So anyway, I got that job, and that was my first guest star, and it was amazing working with Cosby because he's because everything that was written on the page, he did none of it. And you had to improvise with him, you know, and so I learned how to improvise in my first job.
Good baptism of fire there, huh?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, I was sweating bullets. And I remember in those days, you shot two shows. You shot one in the late afternoon, and then you got a dinner break, and then you came back for the – and you had an audience, you know, and then they dismissed that audience. You had a dinner break. The writers did a whole bunch of rewrites. They changed the lines, and then you did the evening show, and that was it. But that was after, whatever, 4 days of rehearsal. It was on the fifth day you'd shoot it. That's how you shoot a sitcom. And I remember at the dinner, one of the writers came up to me and said, listen – because I looked like a deer in headlights. You know, I was stunned because he didn't say a single line that was written. And he said, listen, Bill does that. He's just going to riff and improvise. He comes from stand-up comedy. Just talk and listen. Just talk and listen. You'll be fine. And then we did it the second time, and it flew, and we had a great time. And I remember Richard Gant was the other delivery guy, and Richard was older, more experienced actor, and he and I still, when we still bump into each other occasionally, we still laugh about it to this day. He said, you know, Cosby brought us into his dressing room at one point before we did it, and he said, I don't like all these lines, so we're going to change a few things. You know, and it was just like we're sitting there with the legendary Bill Cosby, and he's rewriting the script and doing what he wants. But he was a genius. So, you know, what do you do when someone's that talented? You give them the tools and the support to do what they do best. You know, he's a superstar and deserved to shine. You know, he made us funny, and he made everybody, you know, everybody got very rich off of, you know, Bill Cosby and those writers.
And so this opened the door for you then.
It did, and then, you know, I then read – the thing that took me to California was they could not – the following year, I did Cosby in 88, December of 88, I guess it was. Actually, I did it right before Christmas, the last show. Then in 89, I was coming back from doing – I'd done a production of Streetcar Named Desire with a very young Mike Chiklis, and Gordana Rashevich, myself, and Jane Fleiss, and we had been out at the Players Theater in Columbus. And I came back from that job and was getting ready to do commercials and find my next stage job. And they had a movie of the week that was a backdoor pilot that was being done by Sony TV and was going to be on NBC. And it was, you know, it was just they couldn't find the guy. And they could not find the guy. Here I am. I got an audition because of my agent again, my managers. And next thing I knew, they said they want to fly you to Los Angeles and screen test you. And I had never even been off Broadway. I'd been off Broadway. I had not been on Broadway. And everybody was like, Kevin, who? You know. And I went out and I screen tested at NBC Studios in Burbank. And they offered me the job. And I was the lead in a movie of the week that was a potential series. It didn't go to series, but all of a sudden I had a lot of agencies contacting me out here. I mean, then the one of the behemoth agencies in those days was Triad, which was bought by William Morris eventually, and they wanted to sign me and a whole bunch of – and I signed with an up-and-coming aggressive agency that I liked and lived out – you know, I remember – I had an audition for Cat on a Hot Tin Roof on Broadway, but it was for the understudy, and I didn't want to be an understudy. And it was like, do I go do an understudy on Broadway where I have the potential to go on, and that would be my Broadway debut and a Tennessee Williams play, which is a dream of mine. I always wanted my Broadway debut to be in a Tennessee Williams play. It was just a weird dream I had. I don't know. Don't ask me why. And do I do that, or do I go move back to Los Angeles and ride the wave of, you know, all these people that want to meet me in the television industry. So I went back to LA, and I lived in LA from the fall of 89 till I moved back to New York in 93. So
have you been there ever since?
Well, no, I went back to New York from 93 to 95. I made my Broadway debut in the 50th anniversary production of The Glass Menagerie with Julie Harris.
That's where you won the Theater World Award, right?
Yeah, I was very lucky. I won a Theater World Award. I was nominated for a Drama Desk, nominated for an Outer Critics Circle Award. Did it with Julie Harris, Calista Flockhart, very young Calista Flockhart, pre-Ally McBeal, and a brilliant Zeljko Ivanek, who's since won the Emmy for Damages. It was a great, you know, and Julie Harris had won 5 Tonys, a legend. I could not have. It was directed by Frank Galati from Steppenwolf, and So I did that. I made my Broadway debut in that. And then
in the following year, your wife won the Theater World Award.
Yeah, and I got to present it to her, which was great. She was in Edward Albee's Three Tall Women, which, you know, won all the off-Broadway awards and also won the Pulitzer Prize. And
that was my sneaky segue into your personal life there. Talk some about your wife. How'd you meet her?
Well, we met in 1993 in Los Angeles. I was a member of a theater company called Incline, a theater group that I'd helped co-found with about 11 other people. Half of us had studied together acting in New York, and the other half had come from Rutgers. We were all Meisner-trained actors, and you know, we wanted to do site-specific theater. We wanted to do plays that hadn't been done before. My wife was out there house-sitting and trying to get a TV gigs, and she knew she'd gotten a master's degree at Rutgers, and so she knew half the people in the company. And she was out there alone, house-sitting, didn't know a lot of people. They said, you know, come to some of our events, our parties. And she had first spied me at an event where I was the producer of the play, and on the closing night party, you know, the final night, she saw the play. It was very moved. It was a play about an AIDS support group, and my wife's brother had passed from AIDS. He had died from AIDS, and she had not wanted to see the play, but was very glad she saw it when she saw it. It was a very cathartic event for her. And that night, she saw me ordering, you know, at the after party. She, you know, after a while, when we're getting close to, you know, midnight or something, I was telling people what to do, yelling out what everybody's responsibilities were for breaking the set down and getting out of there the next day, because we had to, our lease was up. And I remember she said that, you know, in a sort of a, you know, blunt way, she said to her friend, she said, "Who is that asshole who's ruining the party, you know, telling everybody what to do?" At any rate, you know, later on, she auditioned for the company, and she had auditioned a piece that she wrote. And it was such a brilliantly written piece, and she did it so well. We were laughing hysterically, and then literally within a nanosecond, she had us crying. And frightened and crying, that we invited her to join the company. And then we lost a stage manager. We were doing a remounting of the play that I had produced, and we lost an actor. And so I stepped into a role, and we needed a stage manager, and she became our stage manager. And I got to know her a little bit, and we went out secretly for a couple months, because theater companies are terribly, you know, it's like, you know, can you date somebody at the office? And we fell in love, and she said to me '93, and she said to me, I'm moving back to New York. And I was like, yeah, but I've fallen in love with you. And why are you moving back to New York? She said, I'm going to do this little play off Broadway by Edward Albee called Three Tall Women, you know, which was Albee's explosion back in the New York theater scene after he was persona non grata for well over a decade. And was the, you know, Albee's second great coming was the start with that play, which is a classic American play to do. And she said, I'm going to do this little play. We did it in Woodstock in a little barn. Now we're going to do it at the Vineyard Theater. And then it became this sensation, and Time Magazine named it one of its top 10 plays of the year. And, you know, the Three Tall Women's picture was in Time, and, you know. And anyway, she was moving back to do that. And I said, well, I'll come back with you. She had an ex-boyfriend living in her building, and she didn't want to run into him. And so I said, I'll come back for a couple of weeks. Well, a couple of weeks ended up being 2 years, and I wanted to get back on stage. And she was doing Three Tall Women when I was doing Glass Menagerie. I only had like a 3-month run, because we were the Roundabout Theater Company has plays in rep, and she ran for almost 2 years doing her play. And we were doing a lot of theater in those days. And and then that play led to me getting an audition for Almost Perfect. And when I got cast as a series regular opposite Nancy Travis to be her co-star in that on the CBS show, I moved back out to Los Angeles. And then Jordan got cast as Kevin Nealon's wife in a play in a sitcom called Hiller and Diller with Eugene Levy and Richard Lewis and Kevin Nealon. And that brought her out. So then there was a period of time when we were both on sitcoms in Los Angeles as series regulars. And we ended up living in L.A. for 15 years. You know, I went on to do the Roddenberry series and science fiction series, and she went on. We did lots and lots of guest stars and reoccurring roles and TV movies and feature films, and, you know, just going from one gig to the next, and occasionally doing theater gigs still. And we got fed up with that after 15 years and decided, you know, we both turned 50, and I said, you know, we got to go back to New York. We're theater people. And the theater doesn't pay well, but at least you are allowed to grow old on stage still, and they still have roles for people over the age of 50, as opposed to film and television, which you don't see that many that many roles. You know, you'll see one man, one woman, but you know, the bulk of the roles in any TV series or film, or the bulk of the roles are people from the age of 20 to their 40s for the most part, you know, statistically. Right. So, you know, it just gets harder and harder on camera. But, you know, in theater, you've still got a lot of, you can do Shakespeare and classic films. So anyway.
So what's next for you, Kev?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I mean, House of Cards is still quite the thing out there. I'm in the first two episodes of that, and it just got nominated for, like, I think 14 Emmys, and is Netflix and House of Cards is literally changing the landscape of television, and they've sort of invented binge-watching television and, you know, getting all the series at once, which is what Netflix decided to do, which made it sort of – it will be historically noted as the point of departure for the new way to watch television was – with House of Cards. And I think Kevin and Spacey and Robin Wright deserve Emmys. They're both brilliant. You know, Bo Willimon's a great writer, and I mean, really a terrific, terrific writer. And, you know, the series is extremely well produced. And I have about six or seven scenes in this movie called Paranoia with Liam Hemsworth and Harrison Ford and Gary Oldman. Richard Dreyfuss is in it, a whole bunch of other people. Yeah, I work for Harrison Ford. I'm the guy who hires Liam Hemsworth, and it's about an industrial spying and industrial espionage. And it's a thriller, but it's got some very pertinent things to say about, you know, things today in terms of
privacy and all.
Well, privacy, online privacy, not only privacy, but, you know, both copyright and patent law, and, you know, when do we begin to honor, you know, original visions? You know, I mean, Harrison, I think it's Gary Oldman who basically says there's nothing new under the sun. You know, we're just copying everyone and stealing from everyone, and that's capitalism. So it's also it's got a bit of a theme of, you know, is this where we're at in capitalism these days too? So I hope everybody will go out and see it. It's great. You know, if you loved Tom Cruise's movie The Firm years ago.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
You know, once he gets inside the company, and then they find out what he's doing, they want to kill him. It's kind of what they want to do to Liam Hemsworth. It's done as Robert Luketic, the Australian director who directed Legally Blonde, is the director, and he's really done a great job. And Liam is in The Hunger Games, and he's one of the hot young actors up and coming, and Harrison Ford and Gary Oldman are there for everybody who loves great actors and sort of legendary screen actors. So I hope people turn out and watch that.
One last question, and that's, do you ever get back to Baltimore?
Oh, yeah.
You're in Center Stage.
Yeah, my parents, you know, live up in the Timonium area, and I try and get back as often as possible. And I would say that I'm probably down in the Baltimore, Maryland area, in Timonium area, you know, half a dozen times a year at least. Now that I live in New York, when I was living in LA, it was more like two or three times a year. But I love being back in the state. I loved doing An Enemy of the People at Center Stage, you know, by the brilliant Kwame Kwayarma. You know, Baltimore has Kwame Kwayarma is on the cutting edge, is one of the most imaginative, talented, and brilliant artistic directors and theater directors, and he's also a brilliant playwright, an award-winning playwright from England. Baltimore is extremely fortunate to have him for as long as they will have him. So I would say if you can get your rear ends down to Center Stage to see a production down there, do it, because what he's doing is raising the bar, and there's some really great theater being done down there. And I had a wonderful time doing An Enemy of the People. I'm a huge Ibsen fan, and I always wanted to do Ibsen. It was my first chance at it, and I hope I have more there. And I'll be frank, I hope that I can return to Center Stage and do more theater roles in Baltimore, because I get to be in front of family and friends and old teammates. And
it's great that you still still have ties that are important to you down here. And that,
oh, yeah. I'll always be a Marylander. I mean, I'll always be a Baltimorean and a Marylander at heart.
All right.
I'm proud of it. I'm a very proud Ravens and Orioles fan. And I sort of, you know, tease people out here who, you know, are Yankees fans. And listen, I live outside of Manhattan now, and I'm very proud to tell people, you know, Yankees. Let's talk about the Orioles.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you know, they'll do it this year.
The Giants, the Jets. Let's talk about the world champion Ravens. Yeah. You know? So.
Yeah, don't even talk about 1969. Forget about that.
No.
So you could do me a big favor. One of the times you're down here, come by and see me.
Sure.
I think that would be great. We really appreciate that.
We'll do. Yeah, let's make sure that happens.
Kevin, thanks a lot. This has been
a
wonderful show. Very insightful.
Thank you.
And happy to have you on there. You're my first guest of Baltimoreans
that have made it big in the artistic world.
And I like hearing stories that your parents are supportive. I was thinking that when your mother and father helped you out in terms of agents and such, that they had experience from it when your father was basically an agent for your mother before she was a teacher, right, to sell that artwork.
Well, again, that's another thing that's well observed by you. I mean, because it's absolutely accurate. He was her manager or agent, you know. And my dad had great gifts at, and still does, at getting people to just open up and talk and presenting them with ideas and presenting a vision to them. You know, my father really could present a vision to people. He was terrific.
And also, keep us posted on what's going on. World of Kevin Kilner.
Sure.
And I appreciate you being on with Baltimore Internet Radio, and I'll talk to you soon.
Be well, Dave. Be well, Baltimore. Take care.